Welcome to Living Queer, where we explore what it means to be queer in today's world. I'm your host, Erwin De Leon, and today we're joined by director and screenwriter of the documentary Outlaws, James Lewis. James, welcome. It's wonderful to see you again.
You too. Thanks so much for having me on.
Great. So now, thank you. I want to thank you again. I was very fortunate to have seen an earlier cut of your documentary Outlaws, which I believe is in post-production right now, correct?
Yes, it's going to be completed in 3 days.
Oh my gosh, so this will be way after people listen to this.
Well, it's middle of November, so yeah.
Okay, great, wonderful. That's wonderful to hear, because I think it definitely should be out there. So maybe if you can just tell folks about what is Outlaws about and how did it come about?
Great, I'd love to. Yeah, I can't get enough of talking about it still. So Outlaws is a feature documentary about the history of the criminalization of homosexuality and its roots in colonialism. And it features three people who are taking their countries to court at different stages of the process. So for people who don't know how this works, but in countries where homosexuality is criminalized or same-sex acts between consenting adults, it's really hard to decriminalize because most parliamentarians don't really want to own that decision. So the best way to go about it is to litigate. And there's a whole system, a whole movement of people who are trying to make that happen. And they're all incredibly courageous because, as you can imagine, in many places where there's a lot of hostility towards our community, to put your head above the parapet and to litigate, you basically become the most famous gay, trans, lesbian person in that country. And you become a lightning rod, really, to a lot of that ire. And I've always wanted to make this film because we've been supporting a charity called the Human Dignity Trust for about 8 years, and telling stories around the criminalization of homosexuality. And I've always thought there's a feature in this because the history is so rich. And when you really dig into the history, the parallels from as much as 500, 600 years ago, all the way up to today in terms of the scapegoating of, yes, of minority groups for people in power who are trying to retain that power or at least getting even richer, that kind of thing. You know, you can see this thread that runs through history. So the film really shines a light on that to try and give people an opportunity to think a little bit more deeply about how they might be being manipulated into hating a minority group for no good reason. So it's nearly finished and we're really proud of it and we can't wait to get it out into the world. So depending on when people are listening or watching, keep an eye out for it.
So can you tell, without telling everything, about the countries that you featured and the individuals in particular who were such amazing people? I was so inspired by their stories.
They're so incredible, aren't they? So there's three protagonists. One is a woman called Raven Gill, who is from Barbados, and she took her country to court with her co-litigant Rene, and they won their case actually a few years ago. So she's a really great example of somebody who's been through the process and come out the other side, and she's so funny, and she comes with her own specific lived experience as a trans woman, and she brings so much heart and soul to the film. And then there's Rosanna Flamer Caldera, who is from Sri Lanka. And it's a bit complicated there, but she took Sri Lanka to court through the UN because you can't do it locally because of some strange colonial era law. And Rosanna is also extremely funny, really very powerful figure in her community and has affected so much change across the years. So she brings that kind of, she brings so much story in terms of having lived in the US in the 70s and 80s, all the way up to today, living in Sri Lanka and going back to Sri Lanka from the US. Her story is just fantastic and she's so brilliant. And then the third is Friedel Dausab, who's in Namibia, and his court case is a live court case through the film. So there's really three narratives. It's these three people's personal stories, the court case that's happening in Namibia, and the history segment as well.
Yeah, that's what stood out for me, the whole how, you know, you trace and through their stories, how colonization, right, and the history of how it's come to all these anti-LGBTQ plus really has its roots with colonization. So can you say much more about that? That, you know, the whole buggery laws.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's so crazy. I mean, I think some people, most people, maybe some people in our community, maybe less people outside our community have an understanding around the colonial crossover with our rights. But if you, when you really dig into it, it goes back a really long way. And the first state really to criminalize homosexuality was England. And that was in 1533 with the Buggery Act. So Henry VIII, who, I mean, just when you think that man couldn't be any worse, you find out that he is the root of all evil for our community. I mean, it's probably not as simple as that. But in terms of passing a piece of legislation that echoes through the ages, it kind of is that simple. And he passed that law without giving too much away to for personal gain. It wasn't because he had any kind of major hatred towards gay men, which it was a buggery law, sodomy law. So initially affected really gay men more than anybody. And of course, that wasn't even a terminology that would have been used in 1533. Right. So and then what happens is once that law is in place in 1533, it echoes through the centuries, because when England begins to colonize other countries, invade countries all around the world, it takes that legislation with it and imposes those rules of morality on more and more communities everywhere it goes, because it's also then mopped up, wrapped in these very traditional Victorian values. The Victorians were obsessed with sex and obsessed with controlling people's bodies and controlling sex and having very rigid ideas about what is right and what is wrong. And so that is carried all across the planet. So what we see now today is that 65 countries, as I speak, criminalize homosexuality. And I think almost half are Commonwealth countries, because that they come from this British piece of legislation. Other colonial empires also imposed criminalization, but not as much. And I mean, for example, France, they actually decriminalized homosexuality in the 1790s, I believe. So they did then introduce criminalization in a few places because they could see the merits of controlling a population around how they use their body and how they express desire and how they express their personality and their identity. So it's a complicated, convoluted world, but that the core is imperialism.
And that's the thing. I think not just in former colonies of the United Kingdom, but other Western states, I mean, Western countries, right? That so now people in these parts of the world, whether it's Africa, Asia, or Latin America, think that it was always the case, right? That it's always about a man and a woman and there's a right way of being. And when in reality, a lot of pre-colonial societies always had a range of identities, right? And all that.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a really strange flip that's happened over the years, this narrative flip that the film tries to address, which is around debunking these myths. And, you know, for us in the global north, people like me in the global north from countries that were colonizers, there is this sense that, oh, those people in Uganda, Kenya, Jamaica, they're barbaric, how they treat queer people. Which obviously is rich and crazy because the law came from here. And also it's not that long since LGBT people have been accepted in the global north. So it's not like we can say, oh, we've always been so wonderful. Plus, if you're trans and non-binary, then that still remains to be seen. And then in the global south, or at least in criminalizing countries, what we see is this narrative that homosexuality came with the white man. Homosexuality is the white man's disease, as one, I think it was the Kenyan president said that, when in fact criminalization came with the white man. And there are countless examples of tolerating communities, tolerating societies where LGBT people played specific roles in their communities. And maybe it wasn't this, you know, perfect, great big utopia or anything, but there was definitely communities that existed and were tolerated before colonization.
Oh, absolutely, right? And that goes, as you know, I'm from the Philippines, and before Spanish colonization, there were more than two genders. Or if you go to Mexico with the Mushis, you know, it's just that this whole idea that there are only two It's not even gender, I guess, right? Two genders. It was always more fluid, and things have changed. But you mentioned you used the word early on about parallelisms with what's going on. Do you see that? Because yes, all these ideas of what's right and wrong came with colonization and all that. But don't you think that continues to this day with certain groups that still go to Africa or Asia or Latin America?
I think what's happened in the last 20, 30 years, maybe even longer, is that people on the maybe, I guess you would say on the right of politics, I don't know about that terminology a lot of the time. It seems so convoluted these days, doesn't it? But ultimately, non-progressive groups have learned from the past around how to divide and conquer and how to scapegoat minority groups for their own benefit. And I think what we're seeing these days is a real regression to those kinds of think that kind of thinking. And a lot of the people who are in power that we see, particularly in the US and the rise of the far right in Europe, they've understood that when there are times of difficulty, times of scarcity, cost of living crises, that the clever thing to do is to weaponize division. And it's proving to be extremely frighteningly effective, I think, is what we're seeing now, don't you think?
No, I totally agree with you. And truth be told, when I asked that question, I was just thinking more about evangelical Christian groups, right? But you're right about you make a yes, that's true. That's just in their nature. But I think to your point about how let's just, the more conservative forces, whatever terms you want to use, authoritarianism, populism, whatever, how they use it. I don't think it's necessarily that they really believe that queer people are necessarily evil, but it's more that we're a wonderful tool, as it were, to use the term loosely, right? That because just sheer numbers, we're a minority. So let's blame the weakest, right?
It's opportunism, isn't it? And I think there's also this kind of global alliance that's emerged, I think, which is the Christian evangelicals, the nationalists in any nation, the politically conservative, and then you also have the Russian Orthodox Church and the Russian oligarchs who are all bad faith actors in all of this. They are not people who have, I believe, particularly strong opinions. Maybe the Christian evangelicals do, but I think that they see an opportunity and they've gone for it. And you can see it with immigrants as well. It's not just our community that is facing this kind of issue. It's the, I mean, in this country where I am in the UK, we have this huge obsession with small boats. So people who are arriving across the English Channel in small boats. And it's really like a kind of mind illness now. It's like a to contagion that's spreading through society. I do think it is overstated because of the internet and the way that the media thrives on division as well. But it is a growing problem for sure.
I was going to ask this, but you raised something as someone who's in communication and production and all that, and the work you do with your company. How would you address that, right? I totally agree with you with social media and all these platforms. How does one address that? Or can we even, considering that we all now have our silos, right? Even the internet itself, as when you have countries like China or Russia that's beginning to develop its own internet, right? And so my point is that how do we even communicate across these walls that we've built, we as people?
I mean, that is the big question, isn't it? And I don't sleep very well because I'm always thinking about that.
Well,
You
thank
know,
God
I'm
that you
not
do.
to be like, woe is me, but I mean, it's on my mind all the time, not just because I care deeply about how to get this film seen, but also I just, once you see these problems, they become an obsession, I think. But anyway, I think that there's a few things that, I mean, the people who have done really well in recent years in terms of communications. They've told us what to do. They're telling us all the time. Steve Bannon, for example, talks about flood the zone. And it's very simple messaging. And it's it's like bombing communications channels with the same message. Mm-hmm. And it's very effective. But it is also, it costs money. So I think that one of the things that we have really against us at the moment is a funding crisis. One statistic I saw recently was that for every dollar that is spent by the progressive sides around these kind of issues, 20 is spent by the people who want to remove our rights. So that we're really against, we are in an uphill battle. We're being overspent and overspoken, really. But there are lots of things that give me hope. And I think that they give us signals about what to lean into. And it's around what we have in common rather than what divides us. Mm-hmm. There's a huge amount of data and evidence coming out of all sorts of research agency. I run a research agency that, and production company. They're integrated together. Yeah. So we're really interested in surveys and understanding values and attitudes and where people have more in common than we are led to believe. And there's loads of evidence to show that people really do have universal values around kindness, equality, and empathy and care. So I think when we can lean more into those values, then we can find a path forward to bring people into the fold. I think there are a few mistakes that our community has made over the years around communications that need to be addressed. I think we've become maybe a little bit too obsessed with, how do I put it? Like, forcing views on people. And I understand I've been doing it too. I've been doing it, and I've realized recently that I've been doing it to my own family and have absolutely failed as a result of being quite forceful. And I think that we need to do more invitational work that asks people into a conversation.
I have heard that, right? As you know, I'm doing research on LGBTQ plus organizations, and one big thing that came out is communication, right? How we communicate, and to your point, how some of us are more strident in how we think people, what words people should say, including pronouns. But I think the tension is, the tension between holding people accountable and also, making and the reality is, a lot of people have waited. So are we asking that folks wait longer? Or, yeah. I mean, all those nuances and how to make, how to make folks in our community understand why we need to communicate in a certain way and assure them that we're not really taking a step or two back or giving up something.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, what I would love to see is funding and education for our community to learn how to have difficult conversations with people who don't agree with us. It's so hard, isn't it? It's really difficult, and it can go off track very easily, and you can walk away with a bit of trouble. I mean, I think back about when I was in my early 20s, first moved to London, and it was a very different time. It was like the early 2000s. There was a lot of homophobia still around. People were very outspoken still around their homophobia. Did not feel safe in a lot of environments. I remember having conversations with people in pubs where someone would say something quite mean, judgmental, would ask really inappropriate questions about my sex life. And I would always enter that conversation reluctantly, first of all, but then I would always think, I really, really want you to leave this pub thinking, oh, those gay people aren't that bad after all. And it is really, it's sort of sad to look back on, because you feel like you're shrinking yourself or compromising yourself in some way. But I actually think that works. I think that approach does work, and it does mean sacrificing something in that moment. And it's an unpleasant, and I'm sure lots of people don't agree with me. I think there's lots of ways to do this, but that's always been my approach.
Yeah, and I think I think a lot of talking heads and a lot of seriously thinkers have come to realize, unfortunately, we have to find this middle way, right? Where, the reality is there are certain audiences that unfortunately, I guess we'll have to scale back, if you will. But maybe this might be a good time to shift a bit to do you mentioned your the company that you co-founded, The Good Side, right? And as you said, you do a lot of this kind of work. And then your website, I'll quote here, it states that we work with uncommon organizations to define the ideas that shape culture. So tell us more, please. Like, how do you come? Well, first of all, just that idea of forming, because I'm assuming this is a for-profit organ company, right? This is not a not-for-profit or an NGO. So, yeah, how did this, how, what is the inspiration behind all this?
We started, my husband and I started The Good Side. He's an anthropologist, and obviously I'm a filmmaker, and we were really interested in bringing our two skills together to bring more evocative outputs to research projects and working in a more purposeful way, so in a way that would benefit society. So now what we do is it's about a 70-30 split around the kind of organizations we work with. So we work with brands and corporates, helping them understand audiences, markets, attitudes, behaviors, so that they can communicate effectively with people. And then the that work means that we can do low bono and pro bono work for charities and NGOs. And that's doing research, mixed methodologies, research in the same ways that we would with brands, but more about understanding social issues and how to impact them using storytelling. So that's when the filmmaking comes in. We make films about our research, or we make films that come out of the research to try to change a narrative.
So let me ask you, when you work with companies, do you impose your woke agenda on them? Or do they know what they're getting into?
I think they know what they're getting into. I mean, most of the projects that we do for brands don't pose any issue around that anyway. They would we as researchers, our teams have to enter every project agnostically, you know, but we don't work with organizations that we don't really feel are particularly ethical. So we have some pretty clear red lines around who we work with and who we don't work with.
Well, that's clear. Anyone who visits your websites, that's very clear. And yeah, I love it as an academic, of course, when you said mixed methodology, I'm like, oh, wonderful. Bless my heart. So one thing that jumped out at me among your key practices of The Good Side is the practice of human-centered strategy. So perhaps tell our listeners, what does it mean to have a human-centered strategy?
Well, that is a good question. I'm the filmmaker, so I'm not much of a researcher per se, but my understanding is that your North Star is understanding people's attitudes, their values, and their behaviors as an approach to communications. So keeping the person right at the heart of what you're doing and always centering them. But I mean, I know that's not the best answer, but I probably should, I'll just call my, I'll call a researcher
Right, it's
quickly.
like let's get solved, whatever. No, actually, you got it in a way. It's about human-centered design, if I understand it correctly, right? End of the day, it's about centering the human being, the person, right? And so, what fascinated me is that the good side works in finance, tech, and FMCG, which means fast-moving consumer goods. So can you just say just maybe an example of each? Because that's quite a range.
Fast-moving consumer goods, yeah, that's like food,
Okay.
drinks, toiletries,
Okay.
products, small products.
Okay. So you work with companies and how to best product or market the goods, right? So.
So sometimes it's about brand strategy, brand positioning, but quite often it's also brand purpose. So like a company that makes pizzas might come to us and say, we want to have a brand purpose. We want to talk to our consumers about what it is that matters in society to them, and then come up with a strategy around how to spend some of their profits on doing good.
Okay. All right. So is there a particular project that just right now that stands out for you that you are particularly proud of as the co-founder, founder of this organization?
Yeah, I'm really, really proud of our relationship with the charity Movember Foundation. You know, the people who do the moustaches every November, where
Okay.
men grow a moustache for charity. And they do incredible work around men's health. So particular cancers like prostate cancer and testicular cancer, but also men's mental health. And we've been working with them for a number of years now, understanding, well, the suicide rate in young men is extremely high. So understanding why that is and how to communicate with young men and to introduce behavior change strategies so that they can, for example, reach out when they're having a hard time, because young men find that quite difficult. All men, in fact, find that difficult. They're quite good at asking their friends if they're okay, but not very good at saying they're not okay. So we've done some work with YouTube influencers to model positive behaviors. But the most recent piece of work that we've done with Movember that's so interesting and is having really loads of impact at the moment is understanding the influence of the manosphere on young men, which is really interesting as an organization that has such a focus on LGBT issues, because it's almost like diametrically opposed in a way. But I think there's so much crossover, because young men they're seeking community and belonging. That's really what's happening in a lot of those realms of the internet. They're trying to find ways to connect with other people and have solidarity, which is really the same as our community.
Now, I'm glad you brought it up, because you beat me to it. I was actually going to ask you if part of that work is addressing it is that dark space in the internet, right? Where unfortunately a lot of young men, doesn't matter gay, straight, right, out of the need for community, find, right? So that, yeah.
Definitely. I think also there's something, I mean, this is not something that's been looked at particularly in our research, but there's that this flavor to the work that leads me to think that young men have been given messages that tell them that they are on the back foot, that they're experiencing hardship as a result of feminism and other progressive movements,
right,
which, you know, demonstrably is not true. And as a way to get to equality, there's going to be some shifts, but those shifts are giving, I guess they've been, that shift has been weaponized against them, well, against us, fought by them. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting, because I think that young men are finding that there is solidarity in that,
yeah,
in being perceived as having hardship. Mm. And that's something I think we can also recognize. So even in this really, really dark space, these with time where there's so much division in that space, there is something to hold on to that is quite similar there, you know?
Well, absolutely, right? That goes really for both the left or the right, however you want to characterize it, because at the end of the day, it's that need for belonging and a sense of purpose, something larger. But what are your thoughts? Because I can imagine some of our listeners, particularly those who identify as queer and who might say, like, listen, I'm sorry. I mean, these men, these straight guys or whatever, I've been bullied. They're the ones who've caused all these. Why should I care about them? It's like, I'm sorry. I mean, you know, I don't know if that you've heard that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there have been times where I've felt that.
Mm.
And I think that what that points to me is a couple of things. Zach Polanski is the leader of the Green Party in the UK here, and he's having a huge moment of success. Membership is growing, and he's running on very progressive ideals. Mm-hmm. That gives me a lot of hope about what's happening in society here. It flies in the face of what we've been told to understand about the rise of the far right. But he says the best response to hatred is solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about it all the time now.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like the natural thing to do is to move away, isn't it? Is to
right.
go,
mm-hmm.
It's to sort of entrench within your own space. But I think that when there is, it's a call to move forward, which is, and move towards.
Right.
And I think that is not easy. And it's not really, I mean, maybe this is a little bit nihilistic, but I don't know if that is the natural tendency of humans in general. But that, I think, is what our task is on this planet, is to sort of overcome these desires to just be more tribal and to actually open our hearts and move towards difficult conversations. Well, it's not easy.
Well, I think those are the two sides, or the two tendencies that as humans we have to either tribalism or something larger, right? And no, and I do appreciate that. And like you too, I suppose, well, particularly if you would ask me even just 10 years ago, I would say bleep them, right? But when I come to realize, I think the reality, yes, yes, remember there are groups, but within these groups, there are individuals, there are human beings, right? And I was talking to someone more around the issue of Palestine and Israel, right? And this person really is a facilitator and tries to have conversations within people who have taken sides or feel strongly about it. And they just mentioned, just something to me that just stood out. It's like we have to remember when someone is acting in a certain way, it's because it comes from a place of hurt. And that was so powerful, right? Because putting aside, we're not denying oppressions, I'm not denying all that. But as individuals, clearly, like these young men are hurting, but so have we, right? As queer people. And yeah, that's the challenge. How do we, so I guess as individuals and a society, how can we acknowledge that, still keep ourselves accountable and all that good stuff, right?
Totally. I completely agree with you on all of that.
Hmm.
Yeah, when it definitely comes from a place of pain. And I think there is a clear parallel with the levels of loneliness in young men. It's so high. And so that search for community, that search for belonging, but being lonely is a really painful
Absolutely.
experience, right? And then if everybody is in pain, moving towards each other is even harder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because the, yeah, that's where it comes from. So, well, on that happy note, actually, I do have one more question for you. So you are, and you were a journalist, right? Early on. And do you still consider yourself a journalist at this
Oh,
point?
that's a good question. Yeah, when I worked for a news agency for 10 years, and I was a print journalist for about a year on for freelancing. But when I was at Associated Press, I was more of a technical producer. So I was a journalist loosely, I would say. I wasn't really producing stories. I was ensuring that people could do live reports. But yes, I worked in journalism for a long time. I think probably now, thinking about this today, actually, because of the task it takes to make a film like this and to get it out into the world and to raise money and to engage communities and engage people at all levels of society and all levels of the system is now feels like I'm more of an activist than a filmmaker, or maybe a filmmaker activist. I can hyphenate it maybe.
Well, yeah, it's sort of like my with my own, when I tell people, am I a scholar activist or a scholar advocate? But yeah, this is where the nerd comes out in me, like let us parse out the words.
Oh, same. We're a business of nerds with words, always noodling with phrases, trying to get everything exactly right.
Exactly. Well, we try. But anyway, so James, as a member of our community, how do you feel at this current moment?
I feel like at this moment in time, I'm constantly questioning, how far have we really come? How real has the progress been? How easy is it to for it to be undone? And what about the people that haven't enjoyed the progress that we have? How can we bring them with us? And yeah, it's a really difficult time, I think, really difficult. I think that I see a lot of solidarity growing out of this experience. I see people coming together across the acronym more than they have before. We have an annual Trans Pride March, and it's growing year on year. And when you go, it's every type of person. For a while, I think it was mostly trans and non-binary people, but over the years, it's really, really grown. And I think people are coming together.
Oh, that's
And
wonderful.
so I try to look past the negative messaging that says that we are divided, because I refuse to believe it. So yeah, it's heavy. It's really heavy times.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And but my hope is that, yeah, absolutely not denying the difficult times we're in, but still to never forget our resilience and that the joy, yes, in the midst of all this. And I think we see that in Outlaws, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's on purpose. We really didn't want to sort of wallow in any doom. when, you know, to celebrate resilience, you do have to understand hardship. Otherwise, what are you being resilient about?
Yeah.
But we really celebrate resilience in the film, and we tried to create moments of joy that represented what's so special about our community's ability to find joy, even in the darkest times.
And that is my own motivation behind this podcast, right? To just say like, yes, yeah, it's hard, but it doesn't mean that we can't be together. We can't be together in joy and all that. So James, what would you tell our young listeners, particularly our young queer folks?
Oh, wow. What would I tell young people? I would say find your community as quickly as you possibly can. It took me a really long time. It was only really through making Outlaws that I understood community for the first time. I'm 44, so it took me a really long time. And I think that I've found that community was not just having a few things in common, there's that base foundation that we all have, which is the experience of being queer across the acronym. There is so much that we have in common because of that. Yeah. But actually, I found community is about shared purpose.
Yes.
And without purpose, I think it is not so strong. So I would say find your community and find something to believe in and do what you can. Even if you don't have any money or anything, you have some skills and you have a voice and you will not regret it. It will feel really good and it will hopefully help.
And dare I say, us gunkles, gay uncles, are here for them.
I know. I think I'm moving into my elder gay era, which is kind of fun.
Don't talk to me about that. I'm older than you. But listen, I'm actually going to say, as someone, you know, in my 50s, soon to be in my 60s, it's wonderful. And no, it's all good. And I do mean that. I think it's, if I can speak on your behalf, to let the younger folks, our younger siblings, know we are here for them.
Yeah.
Even if we might be a bore to them, but.
Definitely, yeah.
Well, James, thank you very, very much for joining us. And to those listening, please, please, please go see Outlaws. If you'd like to watch a trailer of Outlaws and stay informed about screenings in your area, please visit www.outlawsfilm.com. And to explore the wonderful work of James and the Good Side team, you can go to www.thisisthegoodside.com. Until next time, I'm Erwin De Leon, and this is Living Queer. Be strong and true, and always choose life and joy.